Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Scott Haygood on behalf of the appellant. It's uncontested that Officer Koster had a drinking problem, and it's uncontested that he's rehabilitated himself. What we want to focus on today are three legal issues before
you. Say it's uncontested that he rehabilitated himself?
Yes, Your Honor. He testified at the arbitration at length of the measures that he's endeavored to cure himself of alcoholism. Now, the three issues that we want to focus on today are whether the...
So he's in the process of rehabilitation.
He has not had a relapse since 2013. The three issues that we'd like to focus on today...
What's a relapse?
Well, he's not consumed alcohol.
Is that in the record?
Yes, it is. Well, it's...
I didn't see that.
No, he testifies on Appendix 200 to 203 about his efforts for rehabilitation. You're correct. He doesn't specifically say that he's not drank.
At 246-47, in discussing the inappropriate radio transmissions charge, Mr. Koster said he, quote, drank a little bit too much before making the transmissions, which, according to the record, were completely garbled. Isn't this prior discipline, which involved actions taken by Mr. Koster after drinking on duty, highly relevant to the charge here?
The consumption of alcohol was not on duty. He made the radio transmissions when he was off duty. But what we'd like to focus on is whether they...
Why doesn't that conduct... It's not what you'd like to focus on. It's what we'd like to focus on.
Thank you, counsel.
Why doesn't this conduct undercut your characterization of his drinking in October 2013 as a one-off situation based on unique stresses going on in his life at that time, his wife's problems and PTSD and so on?
Right. Well, unquestionably, he had an alcohol problem. And in 2011, he had an alcohol problem.
Did he seek assistance through the employee assistance program after the initial inappropriate radio transmission charge?
No, Your Honor. But under the agency's collective bargaining agreement, which is for your review de novo, and it's binding policy from the agency, non-discretionary policy, they're obligated, if you look at page 67 of the appendix, it is agreed that the employer's activities in this program are directed toward the resolution of problems that result in the recognizable interference with the officer's conduct and or performance.
So how is that directly relevant to an officer, for example, engaging in conduct which is dangerous to the public?
That's not before the court. He was not engaged in conduct that was dangerous towards the public.
Really? An officer with an armed officer inebriated on duty?
This was an overnight shift. There was no public there. He has sought rehabilitation for his conduct.
You argue that in the blue brief at 22 that the arbitrator erred in refusing to consider evidence of mitigating circumstances not presented at the agency level. And in the red brief, the Park Police state the record itself demonstrates that the arbitrator heard testimony on, and they emphasize, all mitigating factors and simply gave them less weight. Do you agree that the arbitrator at least acknowledged those mitigating factors?
He did listen to testimony because it was presented to him.
So is it your contention he gave them insufficient weight?
It's my contention that he absolved himself of having to consider them on the grounds that they were not presented at the agency level.
He did say it. He said that, especially in with regard to the testimony about the wife having a difficulty of the meeting with immigration people. And that's the point in his opinion where he says expressly, I don't need to consider this.
Correct. And right. That also applied with his ordeal during Hurricane Sandy, which clearly traumatized him.
But let me just ask one question. When I looked at the table of penalties on alcohol, my recollection was that for the first offense, there's a suspension of some time period. Is that correct? What's the table of penalties on alcohol abuse?
I believe the table of penalties, it only warrants removal. It mandates removal after either a second or third attempt or incident of the conduct. And the arbitrator found that since they were just discretionary, the agency could not follow them to the letter and they could aggravate as they found warranted by the conduct.
The record here was that I think that the agency had never dealt with anybody who had been intoxicated on this particular duty at this particular site.
Correct.
But I gather nothing in the record about a pattern of alcohol problems in the service and of varying degrees of discipline given. It just struck me that with a table of penalties that starts at about a 5-day suspension or something like that, and then even the second offense is not greater, that suggested perhaps that the agency had some problems with alcohol and therefore dealt with it in that way.
I think that law enforcement officers in particular do have some incidents of alcoholism because of their stress and their line of work. The agency wanted to get rid of Officer Koster. He was seen as a weirdo in the agency. They wanted him gone.
Well, that's not in the record.
Yeah.
You're implying that from the record.
Actually, the chairman testifies as to his reputation for the agency.
Cite to the record where he says he's a weirdo.
If you look at Appendix 137, the chairman, Ian Glick, testifies on line 4.
What page?
Page 137 of the appendix. Frankly, the reputation is that he is weird. And this sort of stems from the allegations of rape and sexual assault that were dismissed back in 2001, that were essentially held against him by his fellow officers.
He also says he doesn't think that.
He didn't, correct, because he'd had a lot of dealings with him, and he actually explained to his fellow officers that, look, there were no charges filed. He's no weirder than any of us. But the agency allows these sort of rumors to swirl around. There's a suitability document that we mentioned in our brief, that was Union Exhibit 6, where his captain cites, quote, warranted concerns of workplace violence, which they don't even investigate. He's just simply laying the groundwork to get rid of them. But under the collective bargaining agreement and the agency's policy, they have to provide him a chance to rehabilitate himself. And Sergeant Beckett did exactly what the agency is supposed to do. She recognized that he had a problem when he got off the dock, and she'd been with him during Hurricane Sandy 1 year before. She saw that he had a problem. She called EAP for him at the Employee Assistance Program. She provided an authorization slip, and he spoke with EAP. He engaged in the 6 sessions that were covered by the agency. He then continued his private efforts. He attended Alcoholics Anonymous, the Marine League Corps, which he took great solace in, and private psychotherapy to overcome these demons that he's been fighting since 2001, essentially. So he was never given the opportunity to show that he had improved. He was on administrative leave. The agency, during administrative leave, he was rehabilitating himself. The agency finally proposes him for termination almost a year later, in August of 2014. And then they, in 2015, finally issue a final decision on his 19th year of federal service, 1 year before his pension kicks in.
Let me ask a question about the final page of the arbitrator's decision where the 2-day suspension came up. And the arbitrator says the union is correct that the deciding official erred in relying on the 2-day suspension. What was your argument as to why it was error to rely on the 2-day suspension?
Yes.
The reason for it is not given in the opinion.
Right. Well, the deciding official expressly coupled the severity of the conduct with the aggravating factors to impose the penalty.
I understand. So what was wrong with considering the two-day suspension?
The inappropriate radio transmission suspension, that's fair game. That happened in 2011.
I understand that. What this particular one, what the opinion says is the union is correct that the deciding official made a mistake, but he finds it harmless. Well, I want to know what the mistake was.
Okay. The AWOL charge, the conduct occurred in 2011, but he wasn't proposed for discipline until 3 weeks after the October 29th, 2013 conduct. So he wasn't on notice that he was going to be disciplined. He had no idea that he needed to progressively improve himself. And one of the agency's tenets is progressive discipline. The deciding official testifies during the arbitration that they follow progressive discipline.
And so the arbitrator says, shouldn't have considered the AWOL, but I can get there because the 2 days, the radio suspension was legit.
I think the arbitrator simply
build the progressive the punishment based on one instead of two.
I think the arbitrator had made up his mind that the conduct was.
Yeah, I know. What's wrong with the arbitrator saying it's harmless error instead of having two examples of prior discipline? There's just one now, but one plus this is cumulative.
Because, Your Honor, the deciding official repeatedly goes back to the two suspensions during his final decision. He uses the two suspensions to aggravate four of the nine Douglas factors to swing it towards removal and overwhelmingly aggravate the Douglas factors. So the government argues that that the EAP provision, section 28.1 and 28.2, would provide a safe harbor for officers. They could always resort to it and avoid discipline. Here, that's not what happened. Officer Koster did what the policy, the non-discretionary policy, envisions. And he did not invoke EAP. His sergeant invoked it on his behalf, and he was not subject to disciplinary proceedings at that time. So he didn't use it to sort of shield himself from a discipline.
Just so you know, you're into your rebuttal time, but you can keep going.
He didn't use it to shield himself. He used it to make his life better and to finally overcome these demons that have been plaguing him since 2001, essentially. One quick point I'd like to make is that the arbitrator erred by failing to consider mitigating factors on the grounds that the agency did not, that they were not presented to the agency. That's clearly against the case law of Norris. And
Norris gets your remand.
Yes, correct. So I'd like to reserve the remainder of my rebuttal if that's okay.
Go ahead, Mr. Hillman.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court.
Mr. Hillman, in the blue brief at 36, and your opposing counsel argued orally as well, Mr. Koster argues the park police failed to follow progressive discipline by relying on his prior AWOL leave because that discipline was not imposed until after the conduct had issued here. Now the arbitrator found that was harmless because of, quote, due to the extreme nature of Mr. Koster's misconduct. But what evidence do we have that the deciding official would have reached the same result even if he hadn't taken into consideration the AWOL discipline?
Several pieces of evidence, Your Honor. The AWOL suspension is not the only prior instance of misconduct here that Mr.
Well, we know that.
There's the inappropriate radio charge that he admitted.
That's built into the question.
There's a breach of security. And there's another.
The arbitrator is, throughout the opinion, referring to both, right?
The arbitrator or the deciding official?
Oh, both. The deciding official.
The deciding official mentions the two prior suspensions in his discussion of why he doesn't believe that Mr. Koster has the potential for rehabilitation.
Right.
Say that again.
He really, really can't learn because he stubs his toe the first time, right? And then he stubs his toe the second time, and it's sort of getting a little worse, and finally he stubs his toe in a big way.
Yes, Your Honor, although it's not on the third time.
He goes to first base, and he makes a mistake. Second base, he makes a mistake. Third base.
Yes, except there are other instances, and that's actually the reason for the timing of the AWOL charge.
Come back to the presiding judge's question, which I put the finger right on. How do we know that the deciding official comes out the same way if he only has one prior offense?
I think you look at the rest of the deciding official's determination. The severity of the misconduct here, Mr. Koster is a law enforcement officer tasked with enforcing laws, and the misconduct goes directly to the core function of the agency. And it's undisputed that he was so inebriated that night that he was unable to make a coherent radio transmission. He would have been unable to help his fellow officers. So I think the deciding official...
Am I correct that he was driving under the influence? Is that...
Is not in the record, Your Honor. It's I don't actually believe that that's... when he was on the island, he was under the influence, but I don't believe he drove at that time.
Okay.
He stumbled around, and he was on video stumbling around.
Okay, that's right.
And then I believe there's testimony that Sergeant Beckett drove him home after they got off the island because they thought he was in no shape to drive. But you know, he's carrying a firearm. He is there as one of, I believe, two officers on duty, and if he'd be unable to assist his fellow officers or respond to any sort of emergency, I think... that is the main thrust of the deciding official's concern with Mr. Koster's behavior here. And he does say that during the last 4 years, he had been suspended twice.
Are the prior offenses irrelevant?
The prior offenses are certainly relevant. And my earlier point is that there's more than just the two suspensions. There's also the letter of reprimand. And the administrative way that these suspensions happen to fall out, it should not be dispositive of whether progressive discipline was applied. It was applied.
He knew he had been written up on both occasions, right?
Yes. He knew...
written up as opposed to formally disciplined.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's the issue with the AWOL charge. It was one of three incidents in 2011 and 2012. So after the first radio transmission that was from alcohol, there were three incidents in 2011 and 2012. And I believe this is at Appendix 30. There was the security breach where he let an unscreened individual through a security checkpoint. He gave her his card and personal cell phone number. There was the incident where he left his post, and that's ultimately that resulted in the AWOL charge. And then there's the time when he was watching TV in his car and misled his superior about what he was doing. So there are other instances in the record that undermine the deciding official's confidence in the fact that Mr. Koster is able to perform his duties to not commit further acts of misconduct. And, Your Honor...
But the deciding official doesn't specifically tie those to the decision. Those previous events.
Your Honor, I believe in the notice of proposed removal there may be... it's not.
Can we focus on the Norris problem?
Yes, Your Honor.
We have the, at least with regard to the wife's difficulty with immigration, so I don't have to consider that at all, right?
Your Honor's referring to page 53 of the decision. There's a misstatement in the arbitrator's opinion that the wife's immigration interview was not presented. Well, actually, I take that back, Your Honor. There is no Norris problem here because Norris only deals with what the record is before the arbitrator. Norris requires a new record. It requires that it...
Well, Norris requires the deciding the arbitrator or the board to... hear and consider all the evidence, even though it wasn't presented to the agency.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what we know here is that the evidence was heard on all four topics, I believe, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And the arbitrator discusses it in his opinion. He doesn't say that this was irrelevant. He didn't exclude the evidence which would have been improper under Norris. He considers it. This paragraph at the bottom of page 53 can be granted as a little less than perfect clarity, but our position is it goes to the weight that the arbitrator gave those factors. So and that's indicated by the fact that he says, moreover, the union made no specific reference in the notice of proposed removal. So earlier in the discussion, the arbitrator finds that, A, these mitigating factors would not have outweighed the severity of the misconduct, and B, they were sort of very after the fact. They weren't even brought up at the agency level.
What about the language where it says, therefore, there is no ground for now claiming this as a mitigating factor? You're saying that that's a weighing determination?
I think that sentence is properly read with the preceding sentence, Your Honor. That says, moreover, the union made no specific reference in its response to the proposed removal. Therefore, there's no ground now for claiming it as a mitigating factor. I think it is. He's saying that...
Well, the first sentence says it wasn't raised below.
Right. But he's not saying, and therefore I've excluded it. He's saying it's a very after-the-fact explanation.
He doesn't say anything. He doesn't say anything. And then the next time he actually says something, he says there is no ground for now claiming this as a mitigating factor, which you want to read to only refer to the sentence that is previous to it, right?
Right.
But there's nothing saying he considered it.
Furthermore, the union didn't refer to the grievance ordeal during Hurricane Sandy either.
Again, our view is that the arbitrators, considering the
is the arbitrator saying that unless it has some meaning?
Because he's giving it weight. He's saying this was a post-fact explanation that Mr. Koster now throws out. He didn't even put it before the agency, and now he is reaching for other straws when he realized that it didn't that his prior mitigating factors of the 2001 arrest weren't enough. He's now saying, well, it was also the 1 year anniversary of Hurricane Sandy. So he keeps sort of reaching for additional explanations, and the arbitrator rejects those.
He doesn't say, he says there is no ground for now claiming it. How do you explain that? Other than
the language is imprecise, but if.
Well, it seems pretty precise.
Your Honor, he spent a substantial amount of the hearing considering. Hearing evidence, as Judge Clevenger, you pointed out, and then he discusses it in his opinion. If he was under the impression that this was irrelevant because it was not presented to the agency, why spend that time? Why discuss
was
it in the opinion?
Was there any briefing? Was there any briefing?
At the,
did anybody file any briefs? We don't have them. Was there any briefs filed by the arbitrator?
There were closing statements filed, Your Honor.
Only closing statements?
Yes.
No reference to law? No cases cited?
I don't recall right now, and it's not in the record before this court, as to what the...
Well, you would think that Norris would just be plastered all over this case.
There's no Norris problem here, Your Honor, because
I know you're saying there's no Norris problem, but the
sentence to which
the presiding judge just pointed a minute ago suggests strongly that there is a Norris problem.
So you're saying, Judge,
the judge doesn't know about Norris. Maybe the judge's error was explicable. But if the judge knows that he's obligated, that there is a ground for claiming as a mitigating factor information not supplied to the agency but supplied to the arbitrator, right?
And he took that information into account.
So if the judge knows about Norris, he can't write that sentence.
I think... Your Honor is putting too much weight, and Judge Wallach, you as well, into the word claiming. This is not a waiver argument. I think it's just an inartful way of the arbitrator saying that it's too late to claim it as a mitigating factor because it smells like a post hoc explanation when your prior ones didn't work.
Well, what that means, that eviscerates Norris entirely. If an arbitrator can say, well, you've got this new argument now, I'm not much convinced about it, so I'm just not going to pay attention to it.
Well, Norris didn't preclude the board or the arbitrator from weighing post-agency evidence.
No, but he's required to consider it.
And if it was...
Put it on the scales.
Sure.
And to put it on the scales, you claim.
As a mitigating factor.
To put it on the scales as a mitigating factor. That's all that Norris requires. It doesn't require
the weight. Right, but except because there's no ground for putting it on the scales.
Our position is if the arbitrator was excluding this evidence, there would have been language like in Norris where he said, I can't consider it because it wasn't presented. And if it was a strong mitigating factor, you would think the language would be stronger. He would say, well, this would have been a great mitigating factor, but for the fact you didn't present it to the agency,
well,
and now my hands
are
tied.
Mitigating factors are interesting because they're kind of cumulative. I've had a series of problems go way back. If you don't want to go all the way back to the prostitute that set me up, okay, but at least let's start with Hurricane Sandy. And then I've got my love of my life has got these problems. I've got a series of things going wrong in my life. And guess what somebody who has a proclivity to alcohol does when they have all those things going wrong in their life?
One
might, you were suggesting, well, you could poo-poo the business about the wife going to INS to the immigration people, but it might be the single most important thing in his life.
It may well be, but the question before the deciding official and the arbitrator was whether that outweighs the severity of the misconduct.
Well, if he didn't consider it, how would that question be addressed?
I think going to Judge Clevenger's point just now, page 53 indicates that the arbitrator considered Mr. Koster's array of mitigating factors. Now, whether
there's no question. I read the transcript. I didn't get the whole transcript because you have it and we don't. But it's perfectly clear that several stages the arbitrator said, hey, wait a second. Slow down. I've got to get in the picture. I've got to know exactly what happened.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The arbitrator was clearly trying to understand what was going on. But hearing what went on and then having a set of rules about which of what you heard is relevant is what we're talking about.
Sure, but why would the arbitrator spend time hearing evidence on a factor that he, under Norris, didn't think he could consider, or pre-Norris didn't think he
could consider? Good question, because nobody told him about Norris. You, in effect, said that. No legal briefing. Nobody said. The government certainly didn't say, or the agency didn't say, by the way, you should be aware of the fact that mitigating evidence not presented to the agency still has to be considered.
I don't believe that the government tried to exclude this evidence, Your Honor. And again, the post-trial briefing closing statements are not in the record, but I don't believe that when this evidence came up at the hearing, the government attorney stood up and objected and said, hey, this
is
irrelevant.
You're not making an overarching LaChance Duvall argument. When you cite LaChance against Duvall for a minor proposition in your brief on one page. LaChance against Duvall deals with a situation where, for example, an agency is going to remove somebody for two charges, and they say remove. It goes up on appeal, and the arbitrator kicks one of the charges out. The arbitrator can still go ahead and enforce the penalty. So, but you're not making an argument that moves from the difference between kicking out a charge and kicking out a piece of evidence that would goes to the question of the penalty.
Well, I think under Norris, the arbitrator can't kick out pieces of mitigating evidence. He has to consider them. But whether he gives them very little weight because of the severity of the misconduct, being drunk on duty, or
what we know
because they're not persuasive otherwise.
About the wife is he gave no weight to that at all. If you read over on page 54, you might be able to argue that as to some of the other bodies of evidence, he gave some consideration to it but found a reason to not be moved by it.
I think he wasn't moved by it because he says earlier on page 53 that the arbitrator...
Your time's up, so wrap up.
That the grave severity of Mr. Koster's misconduct here outweighed what ever mitigating circumstances there were. And we respectfully request that you affirm this decision. Thank you.
Just have two quick points to make. With regard to the prior disciplinary record, the deciding official only considered the inappropriate radio transmissions and the AWOL charge. He didn't consider any breach of security or letters of reprimand or whatever they were. The second point I'd like to make is that the arbitrator, it's not that the arbitrator didn't weigh the mitigating factors that were not presented to the agency. He didn't consider them. It wasn't a question of weight. He simply absolved himself of having to look at them.
Well, it's an interesting situation because we know he heard the argument.
Correct. He did hear them, and he affirmatively...
At great length.
That was the thrust of the case, was Officer Koster's ordeal during Sandy and his rehabilitation from alcoholism, which caused his conduct. But he expressly declined to consider them. If there's no more questions, I ask that the court reverse and remand this matter.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
This matter is submitted. Next case, please.